Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You know, the 90s is not exactly known as the golden age of comic books, but I think whenever you grow up reading comics in a certain area, it is your personal golden age. So we're going to be returning to my personal golden age of the 90s in what is a somewhat iconic Spider-Man issue today that we'll be looking at. But before I do that, I got to bring in, as always, my partner in comic book crime here on the Second Print Comics podcast. He is the one and only, I believe. Actually, there's two of you because your dad has the same name. There's at least two. Remzo Martinez. What's up, Remzo?
We found three other Remzos: old Remzo, prison Remzo, and possibly a fake Remzo.
Is prison Remzo like prison Mike?
Prison Remzo is kind of like prison Mike, except he's in prison for a murder he committed in San Juan in the early 2000s.
Is he tormented by the Dementors?
I don't know, but old Remzo is dead from COVID. So The Council of Remzos has shrunk drastically the last few years.
The multiversal Remzos?
Yeah.
I'd like to see the Egyptian Remzo. Remzo Tut, I believe.
I would like to see that. I'd like to see dog Remzo. I'd like to see a robot Remzo. I'd like to see all of them.
Cricket, little cricket. I could see he's a little cricket, little cricket Remzo.
Yeah. But what I've noticed is that is like all my other versions who I've found online are all worse people than me or have worse luck than me.
High standard Remzo.
I think I am Remzo Prime.
All right. Well, let's hope so. I hope I got the Prime version anyway.
I hope so.
Certainly too. Paid Prime prices. That being said, Remzo, before we dive into today's issue here on SPC Reissued, do you want to promote some stuff? You're the marketing guy around here.
We've got so much shit coming your way. Degenerate Panel is back this upcoming Sunday for something we are calling Degenerate Theater 3000. That's right. What we do is we take movies that we can legally go ahead and stream online, and me and the panel of Maru Sean, not producer Derek, and one quarter Persian Zed go ahead and lampoon them like your early days in college. This week we are covering our RoboCop movie. It's a fan film put by like 30 college directors about 10 years ago. And what they did was they all took scenes from RoboCop and they redid them in like stupid ways. One of them is a scene where it's all claymation. Another scene is when RoboCop is getting murdered by that guy from that 70s show, and they do it through interpretive dance. They have an all chick version. They have an action figure scene. It is one of the weirdest freaking things you will ever see online, but it is so good. You cannot pass up this opportunity to watch the entire thing with us from start to finish. And that could be an experience that you can enjoy while also supporting the show at patreon.com/secondprintpod.
Well, I know that teaser's got me itching to see it. I'm lucky I don't have to actually pay to watch the stuff, but the rest of you normies out there, as little as five measly bucks a month. Nowadays, that's the price of an issue of Batman or Superman.
At least an issue of Batman or Superman.
Actually, it's a little less after tax. Take it for what you will.
But yeah, we've got that coming up. We've got our monthly gym call right after this live recording. So all that and more for the measly price of what used to be two comics when I was growing up.
It was three for me with change.
Damn.
Yeah.
Hello, darkness, my old friend.
Except for the case of today's issue that we're going to be looking at. Again, this is Amazing Spider-Man number 375. Do you have any idea when this was published, Remzo?
This was published in I'm not going to look at it to find the answer. I'm going to say 1996.
Wow, you're somewhat off. 1993.
1993.
You had the decade right. I'll give you that. And this was a time. Now, I'll show you this cover here. I actually have the original in the vault in Connecticut with the, this was actually like a gold, one of those shiny, fancy gold covers because it is, of course, a 30th anniversary. Oh, the foil
covers, that type of stuff. Was it like 3D too? Would you move it if you moved it with the picture change?
I don't think this one was one of those, like those X-Men's Fatal Attraction covers all had that little 3D thing. This was just a kind of a, not just glossy, but I don't know. It was shiny, Remzo. It was like a mirror cover. Anyway.
Oh, I've got that for the Spider-Man 30th anniversary, the holographic covers. That's what it is. Holographic.
This is part of the Spider-Man 30th. And it's the 30th anniversary of Amazing Spider-Man number one. And also it's number 375. So
yeah, I've got the one off the hollow cover where he looks all silver and shit.
I don't know if it's the same one, but it's very similar to the one
something
I'm talking about
like
here.
That.
Yeah. Anyway, this is
I'm excited though. I even wore my freaking We Are Venom t-shirt.
Oh, nice.
From the Venom movie.
Well, that's quite appropriate.
Let's do it.
Because this does feature what is being billed as the final confrontation between Spider-Man and Venom. Obviously, this would not
They're very loose of that term.
Yeah, final is very, very loose.
Death in the MCU. We'll see you in a year, Miss Marvel.
Exactly. So not only is this sort of a pinnacle moment, while it is not their final confrontation, of course, it is sort of their final confrontation with Venom Eddie Brock as a true supervillain. This is really, it's what I would call Eddie Brock's face turn. And just like in 90s pro wrestling, a lot of times in 90s comics, the characters that gained a lot of popularity were the ones that were often acting in somewhat villainous ways. And as with any good villain, you know, any good villain kind of thinks they're the hero anyway. So when pushed that just right, and if you add just enough of an element of sympathy, you can very easily turn a villain into a somewhat of a hero or an anti-hero, if you will. And in 90s wrestling, again, I'm always going to reference wrestling, we saw so much of this where the guys acting bad would start getting cheered by the audience because they were so cool. And then you put them in some compromising situation. You have them attacked by a larger group or something like that. You do something to build a little sympathy, and then boom, the seed has been planted and we're ready for the face turn. And this was truly Venom's face turn, because right after this issue served as a lead-in to his first miniseries. The Venom Lethal Protector miniseries, which is his first sort of shot at having its own title. And when you have your own title, whether you're quote unquote the face or the heel, you are the lead character, and you are meant to be sort of the draw of the book. So I think this is the first shot at giving what had become a popular villainous character a shot at sort of being his own thing. And often this stuff does fall flat on its face, but in the case of Venom, this is a character that certainly sustained or possibly even increased his popularity over the decades.
Yeah, we're in a weird position right now, because when you look at the first Venom movie release in like 2019, I think that's when it was, 2018, 2019, whenever Infinity War came out, that was when Venom was probably at his most popular, because that was a movie that no one really anticipated to do well. And it broke box office records that summer. Fans really loved it. And then we had that amazing Venom series. Who was writing it? It wasn't Ewing. It was Cates. It was Donnie Cates. It was leading up to the Man in Black limited series. That was when Venom was King probably one of the best titles.
The Man in Black Marvel. Is Will Smith. This is the King in Black.
King in Black. That was it. Venom was at the top of Marvel sales for years. And then it was around the time that Venom 2, Let There Be Carnage came out. They kind of dwindled. So now we're doing this episode at a time where they've gone ahead and announced that Venom 3 should be coming out next year. We've got the guy who plays Baron Mordo from the MCU set to play a villain in that movie. So while the current Venom title seems to be going down, and while Venom anticipation seems to be going down, he just keeps coming back. He is on par with a lot of major heroes now, and they're going to be doing another like Summer of Venom event soon. I mean, when you look at Venom, having grown up when he was just introduced to seeing where he is now, did you ever think he would go from a Spider-Man villain to being somebody who's not only headlining his own movies without Spider-Man, but is taking over cross-title events years and years back-to-back?
It's hard to say what I would have really thought at the time, because this, when I first started reading comics, one of our great patrons, Eric, it was literally an issue of Spider-Man fighting Carnage, and that really struck me as visually. And that's when I got into this, which of course Venom was involved in that whole storyline as well. So to me, when I came into comics, Venom seemed like a really big deal from the beginning. So it wouldn't have seemed really crazy to me at all, I think, to tell me Venom was going to be this huge character, because I didn't know enough about comics to maybe have that sort of those seeds of doubt planted. Of course, if a character like Venom showed up now and you told me in 30 years this character would be this big, I'd say probably not. So I think it is a testament to, really to the creator of the character, who is Todd McFarlane, Bud. And, he created not just a character with a decently cool origin, but tied to a major hero, but he made a visually cool character. And at the end of the day, comics is a visual medium, and Venom's look is simple yet so effective. I mean, it's really just the black Spidey symbiote suit, but with bigger muscles and way scarier looking, almost sort of channeling a little bit of like Riddick Scott's Alien with the teeth and the mouth. And it's simple, effective, and it's sustained itself over time because of the coolness of the character and because they have also treated the character as a big deal really since this issue.
I would say that Venom is the last truly authentic Marvel creation that was good at all. Because really think about it. After that, who do you have?
Miss Marvel. Miles Morales, your boy.
I would still rank him
also
way below
a Spider-Man
Venom.
Knockoff.
I would still rank him below Venom. Like way low. Way low. What good, about, but like, about, you know.
Man. What about Justice from the Guardians of the Galaxy 3000?
He came out a little bit before that.
He might have. I don't know. Either way, it's a joke mention. But either way, I think we agree that Venom is, for a myriad of reasons, has become, really one of the longer lasting, quote unquote, new characters for Marvel. Now, obviously, this character is over 30 years old, not exactly new. But in the grand scheme of things, he's not a legacy character. He's not from an original Silver Age character. He's a modern age character that has sustained itself to be right on the same tier as the modern characters. I mean, you could even argue he's not more popular than Spider-Man, but he's right up there. I mean,
it depends on the day of the week.
Yeah, it might depend on the day of the week as well. So that being said, we now dive into Amazing Spider-Man number 375
from
July 1993 by David Michelinie and penciled by, I believe I've heard you say, is this your favorite Spider-Man artist, Mark Bagley?
Hail to the yeah.
It's hard to argue. I mean, there's a case for Todd McFarlane. There's a case for Eric Larson. And there is absolutely a strong case for Mark Bagley. I think
and
Romita Jr. case or Romita Sr.
Yeah, and I think they're all awesome. I think John Romita Jr. specifically would be my number two underneath Bagley. But I mean, I will always be a sucker for his Ultimate Spider-Man run.
Without thinking about it too deeply, Bagley would at least be in my top three. I'm not in possibly even my top one. I might have McFarlane as number one just because it's Todd McFarlane.
Is it sad that Steve Ditko wouldn't be in my top five?
He probably should be, I guess. But a lot of this is I'm the product of my time. So I grew up in the 90s, and those are the hot artists of the time. I certainly none of them happened without Steve Ditko. So he certainly deserves to be on a list somewhere.
Yeah. For sure.
That being said, we start off. This is sort of picking up a storyline from last issue, number 374, which you can go read yourself if you want on the Marvel Unlimited app. We're not going to really discuss that here today, but that did result in Eddie Brock as Venom kidnapping the parents of Spider-Man. What do you mean the parents? I thought Spider-Man's parents were killed when he was younger or something like that. Remzo, what can you tell me about Spider-Man's parents?
In 30 seconds or less.
Probably the worst part of the 90s of all
Spider-Man.
These
ain't his parents, because if you want to be upset about something, you could be sad about the fact that they are clones created by the Red Skull. They were, according to them, as they suddenly walk back into Peter's life, as Aunt May is undergoing health issues, as his marriage of Mary Jane is not going all that great, his parents show back up, say that they were agents for S.H.I.E.L.D. and the CIA, and that they were on this giant, dastardly, dangerous mission to fight the Red Skull and some evil Russians. They had to go ahead and fake their own death to protect Peter because they were afraid that the Red Skull would go after him. Long story short, none of that seems to be fucking true. It was a whole other type of thing. Clone nonsense. I'm going to save you a lot of headache.
My favorite thing in comics is, and that is like a description of something where you can go on for a minute and then you say, that being said, everything I just said didn't even happen, it turned out, because that happens in comics all the time, the retconning galore. Nonetheless, at this time, Peter does believe these are his regular old parents that were kid. I think they were like kidnapped by the Russians or something, and then got out. Was the story at this time? But
it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
None of it matters.
It truly doesn't matter. Is the point. So really, don't overthink it. Venom is got them captive, and he's saying Richard and Mary Parker, the parents of Peter Parker, in case we didn't know that. No more for now. You belong to us. And so he's kind of being threatening. But then when they talk to him a little bit, he says like, wait, you mean he didn't tell you? Like, he's like, because he doesn't know they have anything. He's like, what do you have to do with Spider-Man? Because he's like, oh, they don't know. We won't tell you either. Like, he doesn't know that he's kind of like Spider-Man's son or cousin or something weird like that, in a way, due to his origin story. But basically in the end here, he says that he's actually holding them captive to keep them safe from Spider-Man because he believes that Spider-Man is a dangerous menace. So as always, with any good villain anyway, the villain doesn't think he's doing something villainous. He thinks he's doing something heroic. At the same time, if you're tying some people up and they're screaming and, you know, crying for their life, maybe you should think twice about whether that's actually the right thing. Remzo, any commentary on Venom's sense of ethics here? You're muted.
Oh, well,
come on. We're live, pal.
Venom used to be bad. Okay. It's like what? Mr. Mackey, Venom used to be bad, used to make bad decisions.
Yeah, but he's getting better. He's working on it. Meanwhile, Spidey, and I like how they often did this with Spider-Man, whether it was, if you remember in Maximum Carnage, he had the taped ribs the whole time, like Diamond Dallas Page in WCW in the 90s. And here he has his shredded Spider-Man costume from his previous encounter with Venom in the last issue. So I always love a little bit of continuity, at least within certain storylines that with Spider-Man, when they show the effects of the battle, whether it's him being, you know, weary and dragged, beaten to the bone like he is in Maximum Carnage, or whether it's just his costume still being ripped because he hasn't had time, you know, to knit himself a new one. I always enjoy that aspect of Spider-Man, which I feel like they don't do often enough in superhero books.
Well, sometimes they do it too egregiously, where it's like they're just messing up costumes just to make up for like bad fights and weak stories. And when they don't do it, it makes it almost seem kind of counterproductive as well, because it's like you want to have us think that, you know, all this crazy shit is going down, these guys are getting like sent through walls and stabbed and stuff, but there's not like a single scratch on them.
Yep. So that being said, Spider-Man is basically just web slinging around and worrying about his parents right now. I guess just aimlessly slinging around the city, like he's just going to randomly spot them. Meanwhile, we see that J. Jonah Jameson is calling on someone for a special job. And that someone is someone I'm going to put you on the spot for right now. Remzo, what can you tell me about Silver Sable and the Wild Pack?
Silver Sable is the leader of the mercenary group, the Wild Pack, from the country, I can never pronounce it, Samarian. She's a Simkarian. Anyway, she's from a foreign fake country.
She's from some made-up country, yes.
Yeah, and basically, she is not only the daughter of the current president, well, former president, depending on where you look at continuity, but she is the country's only export, which means if she's not working, there's literally no GDP.
We have one product.
We have one product.
It's this Pacific mercenary group.
That's like
send help.
That's like if Germany was taking responsibility for the Wagner group right now in Russia. It's just kind of awkward.
That's all we have.
But she started off as a foe. Then she later turned into a very loyal ally of Spider-Man. They've always had this will they, won't they love interest thing going on. And throughout the 90s, she was always there. She's one of the few people that can actually evade most of his spider sense. So that she's pretty dastardly.
All right. And Peter is on the hunt for his parents, and he knows that Venom has him. So he decides to do his own little investigation into the past of Eddie Brock. And he figures out that there's this lawyer that was working with Eddie Brock, but that lawyer, her original last name was Brock. So he realizes this is his wife or his ex-wife. So he's like, fuck ethics, fuck superhero ethics. I'm going to break into this bitch's house and end up having coffee with her once I scare her real good. Breaking and entering is just fine. You could at least knock.
It's New York. Come on.
Anyway, moments later, after she calms down from having a a shredded suited Spider-Man break into her house. They are having coffee and she's telling her all about Eddie Brock, who really was a great guy when he was younger. He just wanted to do good and, you know, be a star reporter. He was disgraced. I don't remember the exact story of why he was disgraced. I think it was in some storyline involving Spider-Man, but that was kind of the moment that he cracked, and then yada yada, he became Venom or whatever. So, but basically he says he finds out that, you know, there's something to Eddie Brock. Like, maybe he's not such a bad guy, you know, that at least the seeds are planted of it. So he heads off and she tells him something about this carnival, as happens in these stories, this fair or something that like is where they first met and meant something to them. So of course, because of this one story, Spider-Man goes, oh yeah, he must have taken him to this place. Because what do you think of this trope? And not just in comics, this is a very, very common storyline trope in movies, TV shows, when there's an investigation and then they find some random old man or something that has some story from 30 years ago, and he mentions a place, and then they say, oh, then he must be in that place. And then lo and behold, they always are in that place.
It's such a cop out.
Lazy writing.
Yeah. I mean, you see this of almost every like murder mystery when some guy like kills his wife or his friends for the death of his wife. It's like, oh, go back to where they first met. He must be hiding out at the abandoned pier or something like that.
Cause that's how we decide where to like take our bodies and whatnot. We think of our fondest memory and then we take the person to that place and wait, and we just wait.
Yeah. Because that's totally how people work.
Indeed. Well, it is how Eddie Brock works, apparently, because he is indeed holding Peter Parker's parents, not really parents, at whatever this place is, the fair and whatnot. Now, so Peter Parker is there just kind of looking around, and then he is confronted by Eddie Brock. Now, this is what did you think of this part where Eddie confronts him kind of as Eddie, not as Venom, but in this, he almost looks like the Punisher with his like leather jacket, but it has the Venom symbol on it. What did you think of just the sort of like, I'm half Eddie Brock, half Venom sort of appearance here?
You know, it takes a bit longer in the comics, but I think they did it really well in the 90s Spider-Man animated series, because what you see a lot of is this, duality, and you got this a lot with the Donny Cates Venom series, this duality between who is really in charge, the Venom symbiote or Eddie Brock, because very early on they try and make it seem like, much like how it was with Peter Parker, the symbiote is bringing out his worst tendencies. The symbiote is evil. The symbiote is trying to control him, which is why Spider-Man has to get rid of it, which is why when it goes to Eddie Brock, it makes Brock into the supervillain. But I don't know if this was by intention or if this was just how things kind of worked out, but they constantly try and make this case for Eddie Brock being the better half, that Venom is the one making him worse, which is why like 20 something years later, now it's like Venom, you know, it was in his nature, but it wasn't always like his intention. Like, he didn't really care. He didn't have a sense of morality, which is why Eddie basically had to teach Venom, the symbiote, how to be a hero. The movies really make this clear. So I think by having us see his face, it's constantly trying to, you know, set that reminder in there. It's like Venom and Eddie Brock are not the same person, much like Spider-Man is Peter Parker, much like, I'll use your Punisher example, the Punisher is Frank Castle. Eddie Brock and Venom are two distinct personalities. They are two distinct characters working in a symbiotic relationship as one. So maybe I'm thinking too much into it. Maybe it just looks artistically good. But that's what I always took from this.
And it's really clear from the dialogue that he is always saying, whether he's in the Eddie face or the Venom face, he's always saying we. And let me break down Eddie's logic to you, of his super villain on his way to being anti-hero logic. He says that the corrupting influence of Spider-Man, you know, they were innocent once too, until the corrupting influence of Spider-Man turned them sort of led them down a path of ending up doing some bad things too. So he's kind of blaming Spider-Man for even him coming in fairly, I guess. Spider-Man did bring it from alternate universe to here for infecting him with the symbiote, which, and that whole situation led them to doing bad things, is sort of his logic here. And he says his logic beyond this, though, is that Richard and Mary Parker, now, of course, now that we know they're clones, he's right about this, but at the time that they were better off in a Russian prison because they were at least far away and safe from the corrupting influence of Peter Parker. He's like, but look, we're going to protect them from you. So he's, for what, in his own twisted logic, they would be better off in a Russian prison than they would be anywhere near your friendly neighborhood Spider-Man. But just as Venom is about to attack, who appears. Lo and behold, it is Annie. Hello, Annie. It is Annie. This is where they got the Annie from the movies, and that's about the only similarities they have in common. And yeah, this kind of lets Venom take his guard down a little bit, go more into that sort of Eddie Brock mode. And, you know, he's like, look, we're not what we used to be. And she's kind of trying to like talk him down from the ledge a little bit. And just like it seems like, you know, she even says like, look, maybe we can have a new start for us. Maybe we can. And right as he's sort of like thinking about, okay, maybe should I do something different here? He gets attacked by the Wild Pack, because that was the mission that J. Jonah Jameson hired the Wild Pack for. In this case, it was to bring in Venom. So they get attacked by, and they are armed with these sonic weapons. By the way, do the Acolytes remind you of any other very generic Marvel team that we talked about in a review once? I want to see if you can look at this like I am. All right, I'll give it up.
X-Force?
You're not far. The Acolytes. Remember the Acolytes from Fatal Attraction?
The future is a hefty responsibility, and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
They were Magneto's sort of little rogue group.
They all just kind of look the same if you just take out like the color palettes. Like, you always have goatee guy, nerd.
These guys
guy.
All look like Forge. They look like they were modeled on Forge and then had different heads put on them.
Yeah. Anyway,
they're pretty lame, but they're lame.
Bandana guy.
You always got to have one bandana guy. They are lame and they are armed with sonic weapons, which of course is particularly harmful to Venom. That is his. The sonic weapons, the sound, and the fire. Those are Venom's weaknesses, as we all know. But instead of defending himself, Venom actually just thinks that, oh, this must have been Peter Parker setting me up. So instead of going after the Wild Pack, he's going after Peter. He's going after Spider-Man. So now we have Spider-Man and fighting Venom. Venom's fighting Spider-Man while he's also getting attacked by these sonic weapons of the Wild Pack. So Venom is kind of starting to get his ass kicked a little bit between Spider-Man, who's really just trying to defend himself. He's not trying to go after Eddie Brock, because he's also trying to sort of talk him down and say, like, look, I had nothing to do with this. I don't know what they're doing here. But at this point, Venom has trust issues, I think it's safe to say. So
that's
really
a pretty safe assumption.
He's not buying this at all. Just as they're about to strike another blow onto Venom, Spider-Man jumps and attacks the Wildcat. So this is like very similar again to what I discussed earlier, how they'll turn someone face in professional wrestling. Oftentimes they'll have two wrestlers that maybe they've been rivals for a long time, which also in a way builds the respect between the two of them. And the one that's going to be turned babyface, he might get attacked by some common enemies of the particular rival, for example. So just to, you know, if you want a picture of the 80s wrestling, you could look at, there was a moment when Randy Savage turned face and he was being attacked by, I think, Honky Tonk Man and a couple other wrestlers. And then
there was somebody called the Honky Tonk Man.
There was, you don't know the Honky Tonk Man, Remzo? Oh, he was great. He was an Elvis impersonator and a wrestler in one. And it was awesome.
That sounds cool.
They were beating up Macho Man Randy Savage, and then out comes Hulk Hogan to save him. And then they become best buds for a year. And that kind of solidifies the face turn, because now they're buddies with the very popular hero. So Macho Man, not only do you see him beat up, so you gain some sympathy for him, but then he is saved by your number one hero in Hulk Hogan. So I'm comparing Spider-Man and Venom to Hulk Hogan and the Macho Man. It's actually a very apt comparison, because Macho Man in the time was also a very sort of a dastardly heel. But he had a very charismatic personality. He was cool, so to speak. And it was in the formula, the seeds were planted for him to become popular immediately by just making a little tweak, just like they are with Venom here.
Okay, now I get all your wrestling terms. Now everything is coming together now.
Eventually, you're going to become a wrestling fan just from all these comparisons someday.
You know what's funny is, ever since the WWE and UFC was put in the same thing, you have a lot of UFC commentators now commentating like they're commentating for the WWE. And vice versa. Has there
been that much of a noticeable difference already?
Oh, yeah.
They barely even signed the paper. The ink's barely dry.
I think it's a mental shift, because now you have people saying like Colby Covington is going through like his villain phase, mm-hmm. and stuff like that. And they're talking about Conor McGregor's, about face as a heel as he's trying to go through his
heroic journey. There you go. Now you're using the terminology. Like,
yeah. Now I'm starting to get it.
This is my quest to slowly transform this into a pro wrestling podcast, and you don't even realize it. One day you just look up and you're talking about WrestleMania 4 with me, and you don't even know what happened. We'll get there.
The only time I've ever watched a full wrestling match was with Logan Paul in Abu Dhabi. That was about it.
That was a great one against Roman Reigns.
That was good. Yeah.
What'd you think as your first full wrestling match?
That was fun.
It was fun, right? Logan Paul is impressive.
My thing is, like, if I'm going to watch people fight each other, I want to watch them like really fight each other. I think that's not criticism.
Or unless it's a comic book movie.
Well, that's totally different.
Wrestling is like the middle ground between UFC and comic book fights. It's like it's exactly in the middle is where pro wrestling happens, because it has that comic book storyline sort of pizzazz. And then you combine it with the sort of real aspect of, say, a UFC, because there is a real aspect in the sense there's real humans doing real things.
They are really hitting each other.
They aren't really hitting each other in the way that it appears they are, but they are really doing a lot of things that take a tremendous amount of athleticism and a lot of things
Paul
that hurt.
Broke his freaking knee.
Exactly. So there you go. Did we just compare Logan Paul to Venom? Is that where we are?
I think he's Eddie Brock.
That may be where we are. Nonetheless, now we have a situation where Spider-Man and Venom haven't exactly teamed up, because Venom still doesn't trust Spider-Man. This whole time he's like threatening Spider-Man while they're cooperating to fight each other against the Wild Pack. But eventually, Venom gets cornered, and again, this is really the moment that I would say solidifies the face turn of Venom in this book. He's been taking a lot of damage because he's been fighting Spider-Man. He gets attacked by from behind by the Wild Pack. He's been hit with sonic weapons, and then they take out the flamethrower, and we all know that is the other weakness that Venom has, is to fire. And actually, the parents of Peter Parker, Richard and Mary Parker, they get surrounded by fire, and he sees this there. He's chanting for help, and he's like, oh no, they're surrounded by fire. One of the few things that can hurt us, perhaps even kill us, but we can't just, and then you see Venom do something heroic. Even though he's the one that put him in this situation in the first place, he jumps over the fire and saves Richard and Mary Parker from the fire. Meanwhile, just when you think, oh, it's all good now, we're all friends here. No, as Spider-Man is fighting the Wild Pack, Venom just bursts into this building, and he is still in a complete rage going after Spider-Man. So it's almost the moment where you think, okay, this is the moment where things get calm and they team up together. Au contraire, mon frère, it is not. Venom, this is not a fast-paced turn. Venom is still feeling the rage and anger towards Spider-Man. So he goes right after Spider-Man once again. Speaking of what we said in the beginning, that this is the final confrontation, this was before Maximum Carnage, right?
Maximum Carnage, because by the time Maximum Carnage comes out, Venom teams up with like Captain America and the New Warriors and Spider-Man to take down the Carnage family.
Yeah, and he had already done. He had already done his miniseries and all that.
That was after Lethal Protector is between the two.
Right. So within like 2 years of this, they were fighting in Maximum Carnage once again. So anyway, that was the final confrontation. So now once again, Spider-Man's like, all right, I've had enough of this. He's just like, how do I get rid of this guy? So now Spider-Man and Venom are fighting each other once again. And I think most of the Wild Pack has sort of been taken out by the two of them at one point. So now it's just back down to mano a mano, Spider a symbiote, as they are battling through. I feel like we saw something similar to this battle, only not with Venom, in like the first Spider-Man movie. That was kind of like at an amusement park against Vulture. That's what kind of this kind of reminded me of, because, you know, a lot of the equipment's coming down.
Oh, you're talking about Homecoming.
Yeah, I'm not imagining that, right? That happened?
Yeah, it happened.
All right, cool. I'm not just imagining things here, as I'm apt to do. Then we see Venom get the advantage on Spider-Man, and he starts taking him out. And then he like covers Spider-Man's face in the symbiote and with his hand. So it's almost like Spider-Man is being suffocated and then having his head like pounded into the steel cinder. Man, I don't know if a spider could take this. I think they're really exaggerating.
I don't think a man could take this.
I think they're really stretching the limits of what I can believe having quote unquote spider strength does to you. Are spiders known as being particularly invulnerable as well?
Not when I step on them.
I don't believe so. So no. I don't think that Peter Parker should be standing, let alone, you know, remaining a superhero after this. But nonetheless,
if Blue Beetle and Booster Gold can both survive Doomsday, but Doomsday can kill Superman, Spider-Man can survive Venom.
That is a damn good point. And yeah, Venom is just going after him, and seemingly like he's about to pass out. Like Spider-Man is thinking to himself, like, you know how they do the thing where the word balloon, the words get smaller and smaller as the character is losing consciousness, and it gets stopped by this pesky Wild Packs are back. The Wild Pack guy, the most forged looking Wild Pack guy, shoots Venom from behind and is just nailing him over and over with this sonic weapon. He's just about to take him out. And this is when he says, after all, our contract does stipulate dead or alive. So he's basically saying, fuck this, I'm not playing around. He's got Venom where he wants him. The symbiote has almost come off entirely, as happens when it's hit with enough sonic weaponry. And just as he's about to deliver, as Fake Forge here is about to deliver the final blast of his sonic weapon, from behind he gets hit by a baseball bat. Oh my gosh, who is it? It's Annie. Annie has made her face turn, joined Eddie Brock on the face turn again, reminiscent of Macho Man, because one thing that solidified, now Macho Man was already with Miss Elizabeth when he was a heel earlier, when he was a bad guy. And part of his character was that he treated her like shit. Later down the line, there even was a moment where he actually slapped Miss Elizabeth in WCW, which I can't believe was on TV, but that happened. So they always kind of portrayed Macho Man as abusive towards Mrs. Elizabeth, which they do not do with Eddie Brock anyway. So, but nonetheless, the point remains, having the love of a beautiful lady at your side who is on the path with you, who is also trying to do the right thing. Not a bad element to have when you're trying to, earn some sympathy with the character as well. So she shellacks this guy, and Venom or Eddie Brock says, thanks, Annie.
Thanks, Annie. Thanks,
you're an Annie. Angel. Now, where were we? So even after all this, once again, he's just ready to go after Spider-Man. Like, he just cannot get over his rage, his heart on for wanting to take out Spider-Man. And Annie's rushing to him. She's like, I don't believe this. Like, I just defended you. I just like saved your life just so you could go kill someone. She's like, I've got to stop it. Like, I got to go get some help. I'm done with this. And right as she's running away, one of these amusement park rides, like the Ferris wheel or something, it's that they have damaged, was about to fall apart. So it's collapsing. And of course, it's about to collapse onto Annie. And then Eddie Brock, who, again, I say Eddie Brock, he's still Venom, but he's barely got a Venom suit on. He's basically a naked Eddie Brock that has a few splotches of symbiote on him left because they're so damaged from the sonic weaponry of the Wild Pack. But he dives in there. He stops it. He is able. And then it looks like he's about to be able to get it himself. But who comes in and helps him? Spider-Man. And this is where Eddie and Spider-Man together throw this Ferris wheel that I hope they have some plans to pay for or something here, because I assume some innocent entrepreneur owns
property damage. Does not exist in the Marvel universe. All right.
It does,
except no one has to pay for it.
I want to start a comic book called Property Damage. And it's just about accounting. It's about an accountant who he works for the firm that always has to go through all the damage.
That's damage control.
Oh, that's damage control.
That's
right?
Damage control.
That already exists. No, yeah. Damn. All right. Well, never mind. No, but mine would be more boring than that. Mine would literally just be a guy in an office constantly sighing and sweating over.
Gosh, shucks. The Avengers blew up another planet.
Yep. Yeah, it's like a weekly comic strip, and it just ends with this, with the same exact thing.
Ben Grimm totaled a fire truck.
This is my pitch. Property damage. Call me if anyone's interested. And then even again, after all this, dude, this is like, this, at some point it becomes like a Family Guy joke when it just keeps happening over and over and over. And he's like, you know, Annie, are you okay? She's like, yeah, I think so.
Annie, are you okay?
And
are
he
you
goes,
okay, Annie?
And then, Annie, are you okay? Woo!
Woo!
And right as he's like Eddie Brock with mostly Venom back at this point. I guess he gained all the Venom power back while they were, you know, pushing this thing off. And then he says, the Venom face comes back on. He says, wonderful, because all that exercise has given us quite an appetite. And she's like, oh my God, again. She's like, blast it, which is a favorite term of mine from comics that you never hear in real life. Blast it, Eddie. Blast it, Eddie. They say you're crazy, but you've never been stupid. Do you see what Spider-Man just did? Like he's in it. Eddie's like finally thinking about it for a second. He's like, help me out here. He saved an innocent life, Eddie. Yes. Just like he always does. Just like you do. And then Eddie says, wait a minute. He's like, this is, you ever see the meme of what's his name? You know, the guy from The Hangover with the beard, but it's a meme from when he has all the math in front of him and he's calculating.
Oh, the Rain Man one.
Yeah, you know what I'm talking about. Everyone knows
counting cards.
Anyway,
yeah.
That's what I picture Eddie Brock doing right
Spider-Man
here.
Spider-Man saved her, therefore I should not eat Spider-Man.
Yeah, he's like, innocent lives minus Spider-Man equals more debt. And he's like, oh, so if we killed him now, all the innocents that he might save in the future would die. Therefore, it's like next line. Therefore, thank you, Annie. We were blind, but now we see. All right, Spider-Man, let's make a deal. And this is a cool panel again when Venom just, he kind of Venoms up, sticks the tongue out and the teeth out and just looks his most Venom. So this is where, you know, Venom maintains his personality and his character here. He is still somewhat villainous in his mannerisms, but he comes to an agreement with Spider-Man. And this is the deal that he offers, which again, doesn't last terribly long. You don't come after us and we won't come after you. Fair enough. And Spidey says, he's thinking to himself, can I live with that? I don't know. And because he has seen Eddie being a villain for years. He's only seen him as a villain. He says, can I live with that for me, for my family to be free of Venom forever? He's like, but that would be a pretty good deal. So, all right, done. So Venom takes off. He says, parting is such sweet sorrow. We can just taste it. So sweet. And he's still Spider-Man is kind of thinking to himself, you know, can I really just let this guy roam free? And he shoots his a little spider tracker onto his ankle, which then Eddie says, ah ha ha, first class only. And he just shucks it off with his little symbiote. He's like, so Spider-Man still thinks he's gonna have a tracker on him. I don't know, he'll probably figure out soon that it didn't go very far. But I like that even with the deal, even with them coming to this agreement, and look, they don't become friends here. They're never friends, you could argue. They're pretty much always rivals and always distrustful of each other, with it, which I do like that they sort of always maintain that animosity toward each other because their origins are tied in together and their entire story is tied in together. But they've had an animosity. What's the feud? Yes, they've had a feud, but I was trying to use animosity as a
the attempt was made.
Anyway, I'm not here for English, all right? I'm here to talk about comics. They've always had this sort of animosity between them. So it would be silly if suddenly you were seeing the Spidey and Venom, you know, two for one team up books, and they were just a happy-go-lucky friends from now on. That really never happened. So I do like that their relationship in the comics always maintains a little tension between it, even when they are battling on the same side, and often they find themselves on the opposite side of things. And that's kind of Spider-Man's conclusion as he goes and finishes his evening with your favorite Spider-Man, a love lover, is of course Mary Jane, as everybody knows. This sets up a couple things, but mostly what it sets up here is there's going to be a lot more to come with clones in Spider-Man's world in the later 90s. Maybe that's something we'll talk about at some point if we get brave enough. But it also, of course, sets up Eddie Brock's Lethal Protector miniseries, which is I don't know if it's fairly well regarded for its writing, but it's I think like the issue one of that is still a
it's
relatively
it's notable for it's marking notable. A distinct change in Venom's trajectory.
So we'll grade the issue, you know, as we normally do, but I also want to get your thoughts on sort of how this launched Venom as his own character in the 90s and whether you would say it was successful or not overall. Take that however you want. You can do the grades first if you like.
I say as a character, what this does is this definitely solidifies that he will almost always be remembered for his villainous origins, but more notably, he authentically has a turn that many villains or many anti-villains don't get, which is they are in the anti-hero category firmly, but they can drift back. In every animated series, Venom is always a villain. In every video game, Venom is always a villain. In every dimensional spin-off, Ultimate Comics, Multiverse, whatever, Venom is always almost a bad guy. But in terms of main continuity, in terms of how the public perceives him thanks to the movies, he is an anti-hero through and through. And in the comics, primarily thanks to Donny Cates, they've solidified that, I think, for the future. I don't think Venom in the comics ever goes back to full villainy. So in terms of this specific issue, I love the Bagley art, but as we discussed in past Spider-Man episodes, such as Maximum Carnage, this is not my favorite version of Bagley. If you want to see my favorite version of Bagley and see how I ranked his artwork, then you got to go back to some of our Ultimate Spider-Man episodes, Way Yonder Back, secondprintcomics.com, or below in your archived feed on your podcaster of choice. It's not my favorite. It's a little bit, in that 90s era type of coloring and everything. I think his rendering of characters is pretty much how he will always be defined, is how he draws people. I'm giving it a three. In terms of story, though, it's
you gave your favorite Spider-Man artist a three.
This isn't my favorite version of him.
All right.
No, this isn't.
That's all right. I have time for a rebuttal. I'll wait.
Yeah. No. I've been pretty consistent. There's 90s Bagley and then there's Ultimate Comics Bagley. And they're very different. Not so different, but like there's a distinct difference. In terms of the story, like it's a lot of action. The dialogue is very 90s kitschy. I don't like some of the pacing. I'll be honest with that. I don't know if that was a writer thing or an art thing. I'm going to go ahead and give this specific issue. I'm going to give it a 2.5. I'm giving this a 5.5 out of 10.
Wow. I don't like this.
I mean, it's just okay. But it's like a step below okay because something just doesn't click for me. And just knowing that this is a pivotal role in Venom's character trajectory, it's certainly not because it was for the memorable writing or because of the memorable artwork. And I still hate that it has to be tied to the whole clone shit with the parents, which gets resolved like I think 5 issues from now, where they finally bring out everything going on with the Red Skull and how it was a plot and all this other shit. It's just wrong. And this leads into the clone era where they kill Aunt May and then they do all that wild shit. I hate it. I just, that taints everything about this.
And we still see the ramifications of it. Every few years, we get a Ben Reilly. Which one's the clone? Which one's not? Sort of like,
oh, Ben Reilly's a psycho now. Oh, no, now he's a hero. No, he's a psycho again. No, he's a hero. No, he's Chasm now.
He currently is the clone still, right? That's still what he is?
Ben Reilly is the clone.
Okay. Anyway. Okay, so what's your 5.5. Wow, okay. Yeah. So this is going to be interesting. So
3 for art, 2.5 for writing.
I'll address the writing first because I was going to give it a fairly high score, relatively speaking, judged on the 90s Spider-Man sort of curve. I was going to give the writing a 4. However, you made a good point, and I'm going to factor this in. Anything involving anything related to clones and any of this bullshit with Spider-Man's parents deserves a grade down just for that inclusion. So I'm going to knock the 4 down to a 3.5. But overall, I do like the storyline. Yes, it's no Shakespeare. There's no Neil Gaiman or no Alan Moore. Someone name on name. But it is a decent way to, I think he does a pretty good job of sort of giving us the character of Venom, showing us why he's villainous, but also showing him why he has that human element of it and giving him enough sympathy between the lady and whatnot and saving Spider-Man's parents to buy him as not a hero, but at least an anti-hero, which is really what they were turning him into while still giving him that main edge while he's still leaving, sort of threatening Spider-Man on the way out. I thought it was relatively well done. So again, because of the clone inclusion, 3.5. Unlike you, this is my favorite Bagley. I love 90s Spider-Man Bagley, and I like it better than Ultimate 2000s Bagley. So I'm giving the art a 4. So this puppy still gets a 7.5 from me. This is one of our bigger gaps.
Surprisingly so. I thought you would be more on my end, but I see where you're coming from. And I think it's good that a few years ago was when we covered Maximum Carnage. And that's when you saw a lot of different writers and a lot of different of the Spider-Man titles and Bagley with like three other artists.
This is such a better Spider-Man and Venom story than Maximum Carnage.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Nice one, simple, straightforward. You know what's going on. There's shades of gray with Venom, but it's otherwise fairly straightforward, whereas that is just a mess. What is that, episode seven?
Something like that. I think I'm pretty consistent with how I ranked his artwork then, and then how I also compared it when it came to the Ultimate stuff. I mean, it's just, at the end of the day, it's a matter of preference. But, I mean, it's also one of those things where it's like, other than Mark Bagley, the only other person who has touched Spider-Man across multiple titles over three decades is John Romita Jr., who is my second favorite Spider-Man artist. I know some people hate him, but
he might end up at my number one if I really sat down and thought about him. I don't know. It might be him or McFarlane. I mean, it's really
McFarlane. I'd say is my three because I like some of his stuff. I don't like all of his stuff for Spider-Man. But I mean, he also is the person who, like, when we think of how like Spider-Man moves and his positions and stuff like that, like that was McFarlane. I mean, we should do an episode just covering the artist one day. That would
maybe we should talk about this subject in our Journey into Mystery call for our $15 patrons and up that we're having as soon as we hop off this this live stream right now. It's at least it's live for our patrons. Just another perk you can get over at Second Print No at patreon.com/secondprintpod, or you can find the links as well. I wasn't totally wrong at secondprintcomics.com. Anyway, for as little as $5 a month, you get tons of bonus content, early access to every single episode, live streams of many of those, as well as bonus content, including the aforementioned Degenerate panel. I just did an episode of What Mark Missed that I brushed out of the old, the tool shed. The woodshed. I brushed it out of somewhere and reviewed Identity Crisis from DC. Thanks again to our patrons for helping us purchase the DC Infinite app where I read that one. So, and of course, I'm also going through Case of the Runs, looking at Jeff Johns, JSA, all sorts of stuff. We got a Guardians of the Galaxy review. Still haven't seen it yet, but Young Remzo, along with our friend Caleb Franz, reviewed that one. Just a plethora of content. Again, as little as five measly bucks a month. Almost the cost. This one was $375, even in 93, Remzo. So for almost a 1993 special edition Spider-Man book that doesn't even have extra pages, by the way. It just has that glossy cover. That was it. That's all you got from this thing.
Muchos dineros.
Anyway, give us money. That's how we end every show, if you want. But if not, you can leave us a five-star rating and a great review on Apple Podcasts. That's the free way to help us.
And if nothing else, remember this, carry it with you, say it to your children before you put them to bed, say it to your lover as you're doing your thing. Read comics and change the world. Good night, America.
Adios.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.